Welcome to Living the Seven Habits, Applications and Insights with Dr. Stephen R. Covey. In his best-selling book and audio program, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey presented an approach to life, work, personal relationships, and self-development based on timeless, universal principles of human effectiveness. Here are the seven habits, which you'll also find printed on the cassette box. Habit 1. Effective people are proactive. They take responsibility for their own lives. Habit 2. Effective people begin with the end in mind. They use personal vision, correct principles, and a deep sense of personal meaning to accomplish tasks and relate to others. Habit 3. Effective people put first things first. They exercise discipline, and they plan and execute according to priorities. Habit 4. Effective people think win-win. They have an abundance mentality and a strong spirit of cooperation. Habit 5. Effective people seek first to understand, then to be understood. They are intent on learning the needs, interests, and concerns of others. Habit 6. Effective people synergize. They know that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and they value and benefit from differences in others. And Habit 7. Effective people sharpen the saw. They are continuously involved in self-renewal and self-improvement. In this new program, Stephen Covey shares his most recent thoughts and experiences for people who are serious about putting the seven habits to work. He provides greater depth and understanding of each of the habits and illustrates ways to live these habits at higher levels of effectiveness. Here is Stephen Covey.
I think one of the best ways to understand the seven habits, in fact, to understand any subject, is to study its opposite. So let me just briefly go through the seven habits of highly ineffective people, and then I'll revisit and restate the seven habits of effective people, and I'll attempt to use the original language, but to teach it in a new way. The first habit of ineffective people is that they don't take responsibility for their own life. They are victimized. They feel like they're under the control of other forces. They're under the control of environmental forces, or other people are doing them in. People are unkind to them. Bosses are dead-ending their careers. Teenage children may be killing the spirit in their home life. Their spouse may be very oppressive and very inconsiderate. Their parents may have abused them on a consistent basis, and they grew up with what is called a shame-based identity out of a dysfunctional family. All of these things could have happened to these individuals, and so they have ample justification and reason to essentially say, I am what other people have made of me. I am what my past has made of me. I am what is happening to me all around today, and not to take responsibility. And people who blame are usually into love-hate relationships with their loved ones. They're filled usually with a lot of anger and even resentment toward sometimes their parents or other people in the past who have perhaps treated them unfairly, unjustly. They're often angry about what's happening out there in the environment, what the government is doing, what their boss is doing, what their organization that they are doing their work in is doing to them. In other words, all these things kind of accumulate and give to them a feeling that I am not responsible. Consequently, all they're doing is essentially living out the agendas that has been given to them before by other people, and they're filled with this state of what I call disempowering self and empowering the forces outside themselves, or even the genetic and psychic forces within themselves. They're empowering them to continue to control their lives. And I do not want to judge the depth and the extent of the injuries that they may have received or are now being oppressed by. All I am saying is, between what happens to us and our response to it is our freedom to choose our response. And that is the key element of the first habit. It's being alive. It's the habit of choosing your response, the habit of awareness that I am a separate person from all that has happened to me, including all of my feelings, my moods, my genetic makeup, and so forth. Now, people who are ineffective usually do not practice habit two, or if they do, they do it very superficially. Habit two begin with the end in mind. Instead, these people begin with no end in mind. They just kind of wander aimlessly. If they set goals, that is because of some temporary environmental pressure upon them to come up with New Year's resolutions or some new goals, but they're not that committed. They have no sense of what their life is about, no sense of personal meaning. There's no sense of their own identity. Consequently, they do not begin with the end in mind. They do not envision the future with the sense that I can influence it, that I am the creative force of my own life. Instead, they think in terms of the reasons why they cannot accomplish things. They hope a lot. They dream a lot. But there's no internal sense of power that I can literally make those things happen if I make my mind up. Habit three, to put first things first. Ineffective people put second things first. They don't put first things first. They might even know what the first things are, but because they're so victimized by circumstances and other people and their past, they are precluded from keeping those first things first. And they end up, in a sense, bogged down in the thick of thin things. And Goethe's statement, things which matter most must never be at the mercy of things which matter least, applies beautifully to them, and they don't know any way out because they are busy, they are into a state of crisis management, they are inundated with all that is happening to them out there, and the only respite that they seek and feel is some break with it. Now, the net effect of these first three habits is that they create an inward lack of identity, lack of personal security, and a sense that the only worth that lies in them comes from other people's opinions of them. It's what I call a scarcity mentality. They see life through a filter or through a lens that says there's only so much. So if they see someone else getting more than they, even if it's a loved one, they might inwardly feel resentment. Outwardly, they might say, I'm happy for you, but inwardly, they are eating their hearts out, and they know it. And they can even secretly delight in the misfortunes of other people. Their security comes too much from the forces outside themselves and not from their own internal sense of worth and integrity. Habit one, in a sense, to be proactive, means that we're alive, that we are living our own lives. We're choosing our own response. The second habit, to begin with the end in mind, is in a sense the test of our meaning. What is our life about? What is our identity? What are we about in life? The third habit is the test of our integrity, our discipline, and our commitment to live by those things. That's the habit of having our lives integrated. We walk our talk. The main thing is to keep the main thing, the main thing. That is a real challenge and a true test of our integrity, of our maturity. Now, the ironic thing is, out of all of this interior work comes an internal power and a maturity that releases us from the terrifying sense of having our security come from the outside. Our security, the locus of it, shifts to the inside. Can you imagine the sense of emancipation, of true liberation, when a person senses that my security, my sense of worth, my identity lies inside me? It lies in things over which I have influence and control, and not in someone's opinion of me, not in the public opinion marketplace, not in how I stack up against other people. Can you see why such an individual would literally experience happiness with the happinesses of other people? that they would actually enjoy other people's successes, because in no way does it take from theirs. They don't come out of what Abraham Maslow called a deficiency state of motivation. Instead, they are in a growth state. They are in a becoming state. They're happy for the successes of others, and they can genuinely sorrow with their misfortunes. They don't secretly harbor hopes to hear about other people's misfortunes. They rejoice in the good things, and they look for the good things, not for the bad. Now, out of that comes the other habits, 4, 5, and 6. They're the habits of our relationships with other people. So habit 4, to think win-win, is just the natural fruit of habits 1, 2, and 3, but in itself is the root to even more fruit in our relationships with others. It'll help produce new things, bonding experiences, the power to influence others to do their own interior work. Then we could call the opposite of that to think win-lose, or to think lose-win, which is a kind of martyrdom step on me again. Everyone else does. I'm no good. See, those attitudes, those approaches are the habits of ineffective people. Probably the more common one, though, is the win-lose, or at least the win. I don't care about whether you win or lose. All I know is I want to win. If there is any contest of wills involved, and if I have a deeply embedded scarcity mentality where I see life as a big contest, as a zero-sum game, as one large piece of pie, and if you get a hunk of it, that means I have less, then I'll tend to go for win-lose. I want my way. I'll look on my kids as being insubordinate and disloyal when they take me on, when they disagree. I look on subordinates in the same way. And then I'll tend to go for win-lose. And if I have enough clout and I have enough of what's called the great jackass theory of human motivation, that is the carrot and the stick, to cause you to jump around like a puppet, then I get my jollies. I get my psychological satisfactions having those kinds of controls on your life. But there's no bonding that takes place. There's nothing that is created that is new that strengthens us both. And then it develops a kind of defensive mentality and an adversarial feeling, even inside marriages, even inside families, and very clearly and obviously inside many, many organizations. And it undermines the emotional bank account, the trust. And when that is shot, then communication is shot, because communication is primarily a function of trust, not of technique. Now, habit 5 we call seek first to understand, then to be understood. Ineffective people do the very opposite. They really do. They want to be understood. They're so filled with how right they are or what their desires are that they see the whole life, in a sense, through that autobiographical stance. In other words, it's their story, their value system, their background, their views, their evaluation. That's what guides their decisions. That's what guides their judgments. And for them to really listen empathically, that is within the frame of mind and heart of another person, takes this enormous internal security and this sense of my own worth so that I can afford to leave myself. See, that's why ineffective people cannot afford to leave themselves. They might try to practice this on superficial issues. They might succeed to some degree, but you take the key issues of their life, what we might call the jugular issues, where they have invested an enormous amount of emotional energy. You take those issues, particularly with the dearest people of their life, and that will be their test. And it will be their undoing as well. And it can lead to more win-lose thinking and feeling no one understands me, and then both look for evidence to validate their perception. And if you look for it, you usually can find it one way or another, even if you misinterpret the motives of another, because our tendency is to judge others by their behavior, ourselves by our intentions. So when we see someone's behavior and we suspect what our intention might be on that behavior, we supply it. And then the net effect is it creates a kind of collusion or a negative energy cycle that feeds upon itself, and the relationship begins to deteriorate. And then they don't synergize. Habit 6 is the habit of creating something together that bonds us. Habit 6, synergize, means that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, that literally the strength of our marriage, the strength of our relationship in this team or in this business or in this school is the fact that we are different, that we think differently, that we see it differently. But can you imagine the amount of personal security it would take to truly, deep in our hearts, not have prejudice, not prejudge, to discover our wife again today, freshly, newly, as if we had never seen her before, to experience our husband on the basis of the experience of today, to experience the son or child or the boss, and not to have to carry the label of yesterday, to not to have to live out of our memory, but to live with imagination, with the potential of what other people have inside them, to live on the basis of what you might call true faith in the potential of other people, and to see in that faith hope for the future, and to have the spirit of charity that follows, so that you are not jumping upon them and looking for evidence to, say, undermine them or to validate some earlier prejudice. So in a sense, habit 4 is the fruit of the first 3 habits, but it is the root of 5 and 6. That is, it is like the tree that has its roots deep into the soil of mutual benefit, of trust, of abundance, of a desire for really valuing other people as you value yourself. Then the natural route to take, like a road, is habit 5. We need to communicate. We need to understand each other, but always to understand the other first. Not to judge, but to understand. It's very interesting that judgment and understanding are almost inimical concepts. Literally, you cannot judge when you understand at the same time. They're mutually exclusive emotions, literally. And it's very ironic. Those who do not judge will not be judged. They will not be judged. They'll find that they'll create an aura around them and a culture around them that is non-judgmental. Why? Because they are so accepting. They notice. They observe. They don't judge. And they seek to understand without judgment. They don't agree or disagree. They're not into sympathy. Empathy is not sympathy. They observe. They notice. They understand. But then they also want to be understood. And out of that interaction flow new insights, new awarenesses that neither of them had before. And if they truly understand each other's deeper needs and interests and concerns, usually the creative right brain enables them to come up with solutions that are truly synergistic. So habit 6 becomes the fruit of 4 and 5. Habit 7 is the habit of continuous renewal. It's the habit we call sharpen the saw. Ineffective people really do not pay the price of sharpening the saw. They fall into what's called entropy. They fall back. They get disordered. They lose their interest and their energy. They're psyched when they get into this material for a few days or something of this nature. But then after a while, it's washed away. And then they've learned only new things to condemn themselves by, because they do not maintain the habit of renewal, the habit of balance, the habit of sharpening the saw, the habit of continuous improvement, the habit of Kaizen, the Japanese word for continuous improvement. And that 1 hour a day will affect the quality of every other hour of that day and the depth and restfulness of one's sleep. Imagine if there were only 7 hours in a week in sharpening the saw, that if it would be so significant a leverage factor on the other 161 hours of the week, we must say that it cannot be neglected. It's the one habit that essentially nurtures and maintains and enhances the other 6.
The 7 habits are much more than simply a list. Each habit has many layers, and at each layer, the habits interact with each other to create interrelationships, like a natural ecosystem. Everything is interconnected. Taken together and understood at these various levels, the 7 habits are the substance of a healthy, proactive life. They create a highly functioning, productive ecosystem. To illustrate this idea of interconnectedness on multiple levels, Stephen offers the image of a spiral staircase.
Take habit 1 to be proactive. At floor 1 on that spiral staircase, if you can see what I mean, at floor 1, the beginning floor, just that you're aware, I am responsible. I am response-able. The awareness that I can think about my thoughts, therefore I am not my thoughts. I can think about my moods, therefore I am not my moods. I can think about my genetic tendencies, therefore I am not those tendencies. I can choose my response to those tendencies. Then, as the spiral staircase goes up to the second floor, proactivity is an altogether different kind of habit, because it has gone through the other six. A certain amount of internal peace has come from 1, 2, and 3. A certain amount of interpersonal success has come from 4, 5, and 6. I have sharpened the saw. I'm into self-renewal. And then I begin to discover a whole new dimension to habit one, to take initiative, to make things happen, to do what's necessary consistent with correct principles which you've established at habit two, to make good things happen in her life. Then gradually that person starts to experience, I'm not just aware. I cannot just choose my own response. I am truly a force of nature. I am the creative force of my own life. I can make things happen. Let's say I don't have a job and I'm looking for some kind of employment. What can I do with my time? I can go to school. Let's say I have no money. I can go to a public library. I can start reading. I can start studying. In fact, I think I'm going to study the business I want a job in. I want to understand their needs, their customers, their suppliers, their interests. And then when I go to them to get a job, I'm going to go with my ducks in line. I'm going to go prepared. I'm not going to be a problem. I am going to be a solution to the problem. That kind of proactivity, that kind of empathy will blow employers away. They're looking for someone who will make things happen, who will reverse some of these downward trends. So in a sense, that becomes the second floor of what it means to be proactive. But now, what's habit two at that floor? See, that changes too. You're living out your mission statement. You're deepening it. You're making it as mature as you can. You're getting a broader understanding, and you're also developing some new goals based upon that mission statement that you developed at floor level, if you see what I mean. Then let's just say maybe you go to the next level. Oh, let's say you're dealing with some very powerful forces that are really crimping your style and that are hurting you, really hurting your feelings, and seems to be damaging your self-esteem to some degree. And you start to discover, maybe I'm not as internally motivated and internally secure as I thought I was. What do you do at this level? You may have to do what Viktor Frankl did, this Austrian psychiatrist. Just choose your own attitude toward what is happening to you. That may be a higher value than the second floor. That is what you created, see? In the second floor, you are the creative force. At the third level, you choose your attitude in a set of circumstances you can do nothing about. And you are going to learn from those circumstances. You are going to ask the question, what is life asking of me now? And you listen inwardly to your response to that. And you gradually develop more internal power over your emotional and your attitudinal state. Your moods tend to even out a little more, a little less up and down. You find that your sense of personal power comes from your honor, by the way that you make and keep promises to yourself. And so that honor gives you more power over your moods. And so you can choose your own response. Eventually, it may lead you to the fourth floor where you can forgive people, where you can forgive your parents, where you're no longer feeding on the resentment of the past. It isn't the snake that bites you that does the serious damage. It's chasing that sucker that drives the poison to the heart. It isn't what happens to us that does the serious damage. It's our chosen response to what's happened to us. As Eleanor Roosevelt put it, no one can make me feel inferior without my consent. As Gandhi said, no one can take away your self-respect if you do not give it to them. It isn't the poisonous snake that bites you that does the serious damage. It's chasing that snake that drives the poison to the heart. It's going after what's happened to you. It's reliving the injury again and again and again. So maybe proactivity at the fourth floor is the ability to truly forgive and forget. I see this as a powerful metaphor, an ecosystem, a body and nature. All of life is an ecosystem. The power of these seven habits lie in the relationship among the habits. And it isn't just the private victory preceding the public victory. That's foundational. But it's also how habits 1, 2, and 3 are related to each other, how 4, 5, and 6 are related to each other. And hopefully as we carry on this discussion, we'll begin to see elaboration of what I am saying now. You'll see how each one of them at the second floor, the third floor, and the fourth floor will be altogether different, just as habit 1 on proactivity. The key is that some things must precede other things. That is a hard learning for people that want quick fix, for people that want simplistic success formulas. But it is probably the most liberating learning they can come to, because they will stop looking for that which ain't so. They'll stop trying to be good in tennis when they have not developed any aerobic capacity. They'll just realize some things are related to other things. The power of the essence of the seven habits is that we're dealing with an ecosystem that is so basic, so foundational, so generic in all of nature, that once people begin to get the spirit of this, it will lead them to where their second habit at the third level will be totally different than what mine may be. What is habit 2? That's your value system. So no matter what you come up with, stick it in habit 2. What's habit 3? You live by it. So no matter what you come up with in habit 2, you try to practice it in habit 3. Well, what's habit 1? The awareness that you can come up with something. In other words, you are responsible. You are the programmer. That's habit 1. The awareness, I'm in charge. I am not a victim. I am not a product of my past. I'm not a product of my genetic makeup. Do those things influence me? Powerfully. But the space between stimulus and response is where we go to work. And as that work is done, it gets larger and larger and larger. That's what's exciting. So no matter what a person may come up with, I think you can put it all under habit 2. Well, then why did we select 4, 5, and 6? Well, try to think of the most generic things with regard to our relationships with people. Can you get any more basic than just saying other people have worth too? Well, that's all habit 4 is. Think win-win. You matter too. Now look at habit 5. What is more basic? That if you do value people, don't you want to understand them? In the emotional bank account, that is always the first deposit, because you don't know what kindness means to them except understanding them from within their frame of reference. Habit 5, do you understand? Now you have the basis on which to make deposits or withdrawals. Without that understanding, you have no basis at all. What's habit 6? What's the fruit of the interaction of people? You're building a relationship. What kind of relationship do you want? Do you want one that is better than what you bring individually and what the other bring? Yeah, you'd like something that is larger than it. You want to have a bonding experience, something that is created by the two of you that was not there before. To have a good date with your child is a good experience. But to create something new, to create a party with that child that was a rich, say, intergenerational family party, or to build something with that child where the two of you work together and you learn to cooperate together and you created something and it's a symbol of that creation, that's bonding. That's more powerful. Those are synergistic fruits. Can you begin to see now how synergy represents something that comes out of the quality of our relationship? That's why these are so foundational. Habit 7 is also generic and foundational, because it means you have to take care of yourself. You have to feed your body or you die. If you don't move your body and exercise it, your muscle will die. They'll atrophy. The key to energy is oxygen. If you don't constantly do this aerobic exercise physically, Your ability, even in your brain, to think will be retarded because you won't get enough oxygen to your brain. Those who have tremendous aerobic capacity through their lungs and their circulatory system, they have so much more energy. They can get involved in so much more activity. They can carry more responsibility. Their shoulders are made equal to the burdens that were placed upon them. They rise to the occasion. Some people have enormous physical capacity, and perhaps they haven't earned it. It's come more genetically. Well, what if they would also continue to exercise? How much larger that capacity would be? Well, what about our mental capacity? What about our capacity to think abstractly at several levels, to communicate clearly, analytically, creatively, to continue to learn, to read? This mental capacity, can you imagine anything more basic and foundational than being endlessly involved in education? What about the renewal of our own spiritual natures? What are we about, really? What's truly important? The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. How do I get back to that so that I don't put the main thing the secondary thing? So if people will sharpen the saw physically, mentally, spiritually, and then they nurture the emotional bank account with their loved ones on a consistent basis, can you think of other things more basic, more foundational than those habits?
By truly living the seven habits, we can create for ourselves a healthy ecosystem. The seven habits allow our strengths to come from within ourselves. But the foundations of the seven habits, the principles upon which they're built, are not internal, but external. They are timeless truths that are self-evident. For example, habit one, be proactive, is based on the principle that we are responsible for our own lives, and we are able to choose our responses to events in our lives. Habit two, begin with the end in mind, is based on the principle that we are creating our own reality. We are the authors of our own stories. Each of the habits grows from natural laws that operate regardless of whether or not we pay attention to them. This is why Stephen Covey refers to them as an ecosystem. They are built on the immutable concepts of trust, integrity, service, and meaning. By living the seven habits, you align yourself with these natural laws. You become principle-centered. One of the fundamental elements of this process is the development of a mission statement. A declaration of who you are and what you are about. What is the source of mission statements? Stephen tells us that they come from our secret lives.
We live three lives. We live our public life. We go often into many social activities that are public and so forth. So that's a pretty self-evident life. The second life is our private life. That's away from the public. Now, we may be alone, or we may choose to be with a particular friend, or with our loved ones in our family, or simply be totally alone. And that's our private life. That interfaces with the public, but we value it. We value both parts to our lives. The third life is part of the other two. It's the significant part. This is our secret life. That's where our heart is. For instance, I could be in a large public setting and put my consciousness into exploring what my motives are. What am I doing here? How can I make a difference? How can I make a contribution in this setting? I'm in my secret life while I'm in a public setting. Or I could be in the mountains alone or on a beach alone and not go into my secret life at all. It isn't until I go inside and ask my heart, what is its motive structure? What really are my desires? It isn't until you begin to become self-aware and explore the programs that you're living out. You stand apart from them. That is one of the unique human endowments that animals do not possess. They do not have the power to stand apart from their programming and to examine it. That's the secret life. Now just look how that unique endowment becomes so vital to all of the habits. Let's say that I'm wanting to work on habit two, to develop a personal mission statement. Obviously, if a person is seriously trying to undertake that effort, they're going into their secret life because they're asking, what is my life about? They're exploring their own life. They can explore their psychic history, their background, their genetic makeup, the present environment, but they're doing it from a different place, from their secret life. That self-awareness then leads to the ability to look at other things, other unique endowments in that secret life. One is our conscience. Our conscience is the internal sense of right and wrong. That is part of our secret life. Now, Freud believed that the conscience is primarily a product of the public life, of society, of the culture. Carl Jung split with Freud on that very point. He acknowledged such a thing as a social conscience, but he said much deeper than the social conscience is what he called a collective unconscious, which has to do with that which is most generic, most foundational of all people, to all people, regardless of their culture, their upbringing, their religion, their race, and that in that collective unconscious is a sense of right and wrong that has been given to us. It's like a unique endowment. We can also visit the power of our mind to create or to imagine that which does not exist now. That's another unique human endowment. Animals act on the basis of memory, not imagination. In that imagination lies our faith and hope for the future. Now notice, when you go into your secret life, you are self-aware, you look at your conscience, and perhaps can examine your life against your conscience. You also look at what's possible, what you can imagine, what you can envision, all while you're into your secret life. And you could do this in your public life or in your private life. We all have the power to do that. All right, now let's just say that I want to work on this personal mission statement. In fact, to make it simpler sometimes, in large organizations, I like to ask them, go into your secret life and ask this fundamental question. What would you like your tombstone to say? What would you like the last sentence that describes your life to say? What's the epitaph? I noticed that General Schwarzkopf was asked that question after the Gulf War by a television interviewer, and he paused for a second and said, a good soldier who served his country and loved his family. Now, if you just think about those few words, they comprise many, many guiding principles, guiding criteria for his life. A good soldier who served his country and loved his family. The principle of service, of love, of goodness, the different roles in his life, his country, his family, his personhood. See, it contains so much. Well, let me just ask, what would you like your epitaph to say? Now pause. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to observe what might be happening in your mind as you pause. You're looking at yourself. There's the endowment of self-awareness. You're probably using your imagination and thinking about your future. Now you're using the unique endowment of imagination. My guess is you're also finding that the very essence of your nature is that it is moral, that you have a conscience, you have a sense of what is right and what is wrong, even apart from your upbringing. That may be part of it, but you may distinguish between the two. Now listen to it. Now remember, you won't receive any social or public affirmation for this effort. In fact, it may not be a normal part of your private life at all to ever visit your secret life, to go into your heart. But here you're making the effort. There's another unique human endowment. It's called willpower, independent will. So you have to explore, am I really willing to go the distance on this epitaph, these values that I'm trying to internalize into my life? Am I really willing to walk this talk? Am I really willing to put these first things first, habit 3, that's where you go through the internal dialogue.